Candice Bergen grew up in Hollywood, the daughter of a world-famous ventriloquist. She's appeared in numerous movies, including The Sand Pebbles, Carnal Knowledge, Starting Over, and Miss Congeniality. On television, she made headlines as the tough-talking journalist Murphy Brown, for which she won 5 Emmys. She later starred in the TV series Boston Legal. Her most recent Broadway appearances include Gore Vidal's The Best Man and A.R. Gurney's Love Letters. In 1984, she wrote the best-selling memoir, Knock Wood, covering the life, her life up to that point. And now she's written a follow-up memoir, A Fine Romance, which is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased to welcome Candice Bergen to our show today.
Welcome back. Nice to see you again.
Whom does the Fine Romance of your title refer to? Not Fred Astaire.
But he certainly was the inspiration. It primarily refers to the love that I found for my daughter the second she was born. It's about the love between my late husband and myself, and then the surprise relationship with my current husband. But it's primarily the love between a mom and a daughter.
Do you take pride in the fact that you had what you refer to as a weird upbringing?
I'm so proud of that, because nobody has had a childhood like mine, and I just love it.
To start with, you were known for many years as Charlie McCarthy's younger sister, and you didn't love it for a long time.
No, I didn't.
How did it, because you were playing second fiddle to a puppet?
Well, you see, in my house, he was no mere puppet. My father had to fight with him to get first billing. It was known as the Charlie McCarthy Show with Edgar Bergen. And Charlie in our household was really like a major head of state.
And is it true that your father would put Charlie on one knee and then you on his other knee and get a conversation going?
Yes, I mean, this was not when I was in my 20s.
No, this is at the breakfast table when you were a kid.
This is at the breakfast table when I was maybe 5 or 6, and he would put me on one knee and Charlie on the other, and when he would squeeze the back of my neck, that was my signal to move my mouth, and he would provide the voices for both Charlie
and I. For both
of
you?
Yes.
So you weren't even able to voice your own opinions on these things, but you were part of a comedy act.
Yes, a very quiet, private comedy act.
It would be hard not to have a sibling rivalry, since Charlie had his own bedroom next to yours and his was bigger.
It's true.
Did you ever ask your parents if you could switch rooms with him? And what happened to Mortimer? Did he get short shrift, Mortimer Snurd?
Mortimer did not have residential privileges. Mortimer lived in a trunk at the office.
But you still got the smaller bedroom. What was in Charlie's bedroom that where he needed one so big?
Well, he had his own dresser with his own clothes. I do hasten to add that my room was a corner room, however, though it was a modest room. And Charlie had his own little desk at the office, a little blonde pine wood modernist desk with Charlie McCarthy on the nameplate. He had a very definite presence.
And that's kind of surreal, growing up in a surreal situation.
Well, when you grow up in it, you don't know that it's surreal.
Did you know in advance that Charlie would get a bequest in your father's will when he died, while you didn't even get mentioned?
No, that was a surprise.
What do you think he was thinking?
You know, my father was not an irrational man. My father was as grounded and as unpretentious as anyone I've ever met.
And incredibly funny.
He was very funny, but he was also Swedish, so he was sometimes funny, and sometimes he was just very quiet and introverted. And what my father was, when he had a section in the will devoted to Charlie, it was recognizing the impact of this character that he created on his life and on mine, I might add.
Well, you didn't need the money, but it still hurts, I think, I'm sure. Your only brother, Chris, is 15 years younger than you.
Yes.
Was he left anything?
He was.
Was his upbringing different from yours? Had the family dynamic changed?
Well, my brother said we would call each other pal. And he said, you know, pal, when you were growing up, Charlie had his own room. When I was growing up, he lived in a trunk in the hall. So my father's career was in its descendants. And And so, yes, Charlie was no longer the life force of the house.
Some years ago, we had the man behind Elmo who came on our show, and he had a suitcase with him. And my producer said, "You can leave the suitcase in the ready room." He said, "I cannot. That's Elmo."
Yeah. So,
and he was responding to him as though he was a real person.
Well, Leonard, this should not surprise you. And I have heard many I remember a friend of mine was on a ship with a famous puppeteer called Bert Clampett, who created the character Beulah, who was a witch. Mm-hmm. And she was on television, and I loved Beulah. And my friend came into his stateroom one evening and opened the door, and he was in bed with Beulah next to him in bed. And she said, "My God, you sleep with Beulah?" He said, "I always sleep with Beulah."
Hmm. Well,
it's a very delicate, complicated dance.
Let's get back to your memoir. Your first memoir, Knock Wood, concentrated on your childhood and your life as a young adult. And this book starts with the birth of your daughter and then flashes back to your marriage to Louis Malle, the celebrated French movie director. Do you see the two memoirs as continuous, or was there a real break in your life at one point?
Well, there was not a break in my life. I mean, my husband died in 1995.
Very young, actually.
Very young.
62, was he?
63. Hmm. And he had just turned 63. And then I did Murphy Brown for 3 or 4 more years.
Had you been tempted to marry before you met Louis?
No, I'd been asked, but I never came close, really.
And he died young, but he was the director of many well-received films in the United States and France, including Elevated to the Gallows with that famous score by Miles Davis.
Yeah.
The Lovers, which played an important role in U.S. censorship history. It went to the Supreme Court. My Dinner with Andre, Pretty Baby, Atlantic City, Comme Lucien, Au revoir les enfants, Vanya on 42nd Street. Did you ever discuss working together on a project?
We discussed it, but we thought, first of all, I don't think I could have been an actor in Louis' movies. I was not capable of that kind of subtlety in my acting. But but we talked about it, but he thought, he just said, it's difficult enough directing actors, but then coming home and not being able to escape them is just asking too much. And of course, he was right.
You write that you consider Louis an artist while your career dealt strictly in commerce, but can't carnal knowledge, Gandhi, and starting over be considered art?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I mean, I'm not being overly self-effacive, but really what I contributed to those movies was rather modest.
You did have many shared interests, but there were a few major differences between the two of you. You were raised in California luxury, and he was raised in a magnificent medieval chateau in the southwest of France.
No, he was not raised there. That's the house that he bought, I don't know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, but he was raised in Lille in France. His family were they made beet sugar. They were one of the two from the Napoleonic era. They were one of the two prime sugar manufacturers.
So he didn't grow up poor?
No, not at all.
When you took down a row of 15-foot hedges around the pool in France because it felt claustrophobic, Louis told you, "This is not Bel Air."
Yes, but I could try. The house in the southwest of France is a very beautiful house. It's from the 15th century onward. It's not a suburban tract house. It has great roots and great character and sort of mystery, but it tended to austere. Mm-hmm. So I just opened it up a little bit.
And were you ever able to reconcile the differences?
Well, I mean,
in style, I'm talking about.
Actually, our apartments were very similar in taste. So Louis moved into my apartment, and his Indian Tonka's just went very well with all of my Indian sculptures, and his carpets worked with my Persian carpets. So in many ways, our taste was similar.
I'm talking with Candace Bergen, who has written a second memoir, this one, A Fine Romance. It is published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Talking of India, shortly after your marriage, you got the opportunity to perform in the movie Gandhi, playing the great photographer Margaret Burke White. Hadn't Louis gotten into trouble with the Indian government for a documentary he'd made years before?
Oh, he had been banned from ever entering India, and I believe the ban had just been lifted, and it was his first time back in the country. He made a 9-hour documentary on India that he and two other crew members, he did his own camera work, and he did the wrote and did the narration, and it
was an award-winning documentary.
It was award-winning, and it was shown on BBC and in America, and India was offended because he had shown poverty in India, which is frankly very hard to avoid if you're in the country. And so when he arrived to visit me in India, on the front page of the Bombay Daily or the Herald, there was a tiny headline that said, Louis Malle is back in town, which he loved, of course.
But India was often called the world's greatest democracy. It's kind of shocking that they would have banned him from making a movie, although more recently wasn't the BBC that got into trouble for talking with a rapist in his jail cell?
In India? The BBC was kicked out of India after they ran Louis's movie called Phantom India. So it's not the first time the BBC has gotten in trouble in India.
When he joined you, did he take you to places that you might not have gone to otherwise?
Well, we were in Bombay at the same time as one of my oldest friends, Mary Ellen Mark, who's one of our greatest photographers, and she had managed to gain access to an area in Bombay where the Cage Girls worked and lived, and it was former stables that were made into sort of pods, which is stables for where women would work as prostitutes, and they were women as young as 10, 11, 12, and it was a taste of poverty that I never hope to have again.
It's good that you didn't make a film about it. You would have been banned from India.
That's true.
But she's gone back many times, Mary Ellen Mark.
She goes to India like people go to the Caribbean. For her, it's a vacation. She loves India. She knows it unlike almost any other person. And she was friendly with all of the Cage Girl madams, and she would go back and forth. She'd bring them Tylenol and wigs and nightgowns. I mean, they were so thrilled to see her.
Did you and Louis hesitate before deciding to have a child?
Oh, well, we didn't for almost 5 years.
Well, he had children.
He has two children.
Did that bother you that he maintained such close relations with the mothers of his two kids?
Well, it bothered me in the sense that they were freely coming to the house to stay while we were there, and so that was a slight bump in the road. But we got over it, And his kids are just wonderful kids that I love them very much.
One of them was Alexandra Stewart, who's a pretty great actress, an American who's made
a career
in France. Oh, but she's made a real career in France.
She's spent her life in France.
Did the baby, who's now your adult daughter, Chloe, change your priorities?
Oh, yeah.
Well, some people just continue going on with their careers. You stopped for a while?
I stopped working for 3 years, and then I was getting a little crazy, and so I would do occasionally a week someplace, and then when she was 4 and a half, I got the offer to do Murphy, and it seemed like the only way to combine working with knowing where one would be past, say, the next week.
Murphy allowed you to do comedy.
Yes, very much so.
You were absolutely great in comedy, but you hadn't done much comedy before. Why do you think that was?
I think I had a certain coolness to my looks that people thought would never. I mean, they just didn't think humor would be possible in someone who looked like me. But in fact, it was where I was at my most comfortable.
Your looks really have played a role in your life. In fact, didn't Warren Beatty once talk to you about that?
Well, we
how they determine your life in some ways.
I did a movie that Warren wrote and directed and produced and stars in. I don't even know the name of the movie, but it's about Howard Hughes because I never saw a script. I knew nothing. I was just on set for a few days. But Warren, who I'd known for 50 years, said we were talking about the old days and beauty, and he said, you know, he said it opens any door. He said it gives you a backstage pass.
And it led you into a modeling career for a time.
I modeled during summers when I was in college, so it wasn't really a full-fledged modeling career.
I understand that Warren Beatty's still working on that film.
I don't know that he'll ever stop.
Well, you have to wonder why. He's had successes in the past. It's not like Orson Welles, who made great movies but never could get any financing.
Yes, there are differing stories on Orson and financing, but it was wonderful to be on a set with Warren because he's clearly in control and has great gifts.
My guest is Candace Bergen, who has written a memoir, her second memoir. This one's called A Fine Romance. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and we will take a little break and come back with more. And we're back with Candace Bergen. She's written a second memoir, a follow-up to her bestseller, Knock Wood. This one, A Fine Romance, published by Simon & Schuster. When you received the first script for Murphy Brown, did you find it something that you thought you really wanted to do?
I thought it was as if it were written for me. I wanted to do it so badly. I just thought the writing was of a level and a wit, and it reminded me of the great comedies of the 40s. It was so fast and smart and sassy. I was just what I would have been crushed if I hadn't had the chance to do it.
And then the network wanted Diane English, its creator, to adjust the character.
Yes. Well, first of all, they wanted her to adjust it so that it was not cast with me. They wanted Heather Locklear to star in it, and they wanted Murphy. Murphy and the pilot came off the elevator, and she had just spent a month for alcoholism being treated at Betty Ford. And they said, well, does she have to come back after a month at Betty Ford? Couldn't she just come back after a weekend at a spa? Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to defang Murphy, which, of course, the whole point of Murphy was that she had teeth.
Mm-hmm. And actually, we see a lot more of that kind of comedy today. I suspect Murphy Brown is one of the reasons, the success of it is one of the reasons comedies have gotten tougher today. And we have main characters who have flaws.
Yes, Murphy was never mean, but certainly she was relentless, and she would back down for no one and could be very pesty. My mission was always to have Murphy redeemed by the end of each episode.
You were nominated for an Academy Award for Starting Over with Burt Reynolds, where you had a chance to sing. And there's a famous scene in Murphy Brown where you sing Respect.
Oh, well, I sang a few times in Murphy Brown. It just would be still my heart. I was so happy.
Your mother had sung.
My mother was, in fact, an excellent singer and had made an album. But one of the times I sang on Murphy, I was sitting next to Aretha Franklin on the piano bench singing Natural Woman. And that was as scared as I've ever been, basically.
Well, did you think you sang well?
Of course I didn't. The whole point was that I was a horrible singer. But there was such a joy in not only admitting to that, but to sort of flaunting it.
I've heard people try to sing off key, and you can always tell. But the people who really can't sing in key, you know right away that that's just they're just naturals.
That would be me.
How did you balance the routine of filming a weekly series with taking care of a kid?
Well, on a half-hour show, you have a week off a month, and you get to work at 9:30 or 10 in the morning. So I could take my daughter to preschool, and then subsequently I could do carpool in the mornings, and I could be home by 5 and have supper with her and, you know, be with her when she had her bath. And then I would have a week off a month where I could be at school and serve lunches and do parent functions, which is in a large part of the reason that I wanted to do Murphy, because when you have a child over a certain age, you want to know where you're going to be and to have a predictability.
What about its effect on your marriage? These days it probably would have been shot in New York, but then it was L.A., and Louis was spending a lot of his time here and in France.
It was very hard on our marriage. That's where life got messy.
Why do you think suddenly New York is where so many of these shows are being filmed?
Well, I think that Mayor Bloomberg was very accommodating in terms of tax incentives that he created because before that, nobody could even think of shooting in New York. It was just prohibitive.
And now you have a show like The Good Wife taking place in Chicago. Obviously in Greenpoint. You have The Americans in Washington. It's shot in Greenpoint. Then you have some shows like Girls that are meant to be seen as being shot in Greenpoint. But it's really
tying up traffic wherever you go. But it's great.
You write that, like many women at the time, you wanted to be Murphy Brown. What did you admire about the character?
Oh, I think because of the era that I grew up in, I loved that she didn't care what people thought of her. I loved that she knew what she wanted, that she went after it, that she was as good as any man in her field, which was a field of television journalism, which until then had been fairly closed to women, and that she had a brashness and a confidence, that she was bratty. I thought that was just really fun to play.
And that wasn't like you in real life?
Well, I can be very bratty, but...
I didn't mean the bratty
but
part,
only,
I just
but
meant...
No, I, that in fact, but only when I'm with my friends.
Uh-huh.
I loved that she had a sense of self that was without boundaries.
It was a critical and commercial hit. You won 5 Emmy Awards, the most for one person playing the same role. But you also say that it was important for you to always keep her from being too abrasive, to keep her human.
Yeah.
And was that something that you did as an actor, or was that also in the script? Did you insist on script changes?
Yeah. I mean, in television, obviously, the writer is the master, but... But I would have arguments often about Murphy, and the just lifting her, redeeming her by the end of each episode so that she was not just an unbearable shrew. Really, it was a fine line.
When she became a mother in 1992, did anyone anticipate the repercussions?
Ha! Huh. Certainly not. Who could have thought? I mean, who could have even envisioned such a thing?
I'm sure that in retrospect, Vice President Dan Quayle's famous speech about Murphy Brown was actually a great boost for the show. It gave you all sorts of publicity that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
Oh, it made us number one, number two show for a couple of months. We owe him everything, in fact.
The Hollywood community often made fun of Quayle for his misstatements and his misspellings, as well as for some of his policies. Do you think he was trying to get even?
He would have been entitled. I mean, he certainly, but he also should have known that you don't take on television writers without paying a price. But I mean, he was in fact quite savvy. He that the remark about Murphy Brown and having a baby while dismissing the importance of fathers, had been removed from the speech and deleted, and he put it back in. He reinserted it, and of course, his campaign with George W. Bush was then based on family values, a platform then later embraced by Bill Clinton.
I would assume some of the people who were advertisers on the show were in support of Bush Quayle. Did that affect? Did you have anybody canceling their ads?
Things were jogged off track a few times, just in many ways. And from that time, we always had security at the show when we were shooting an episode. We had metal detectors. I mean, I had security who.
Anybody threaten you? Today, of course, with the internet, you might have.
Open season. Yeah. No, yes, there were threats.
Months after Quayle's speech, Bill Clinton raised the issue in his campaign, and you were on the cover of Time magazine suggesting that Murphy should run for president.
I didn't suggest it, but I was wearing a button that said Murphy Brown for president, so I sort of implied it. You're absolutely right.
And then there was an episode where Murphy is watching Dan Quayle on television talking about her. That was very clever.
Well, that was responding to the whole brouhaha. It was the opening episode for that season after Murphy had had the baby, and they played a little clip of Quayle's speech and said, "We're making single mothers glamorous." She's, "Frank, am I glamorous? Look at me." And she's in her old pajamas and a T-shirt. That was quite a year.
Candace Bergen is my guest. Her memoir, A Fine Romance, is published by Simon & Schuster. And that show ran for 10 years. That's a long run.
It was too long. Let me just hasten to say. It was
88 to 98?
Yeah. But, you know, it was the same group of people, the same cast, the same crew. And we loved each other. We loved working together. The money was incredible. And for me, it was very comforting to come back to the structure of that show after my husband had died. I just didn't want to then cast myself adrift right afterwards.
While you were shooting it, Louis Malle became ill, what turned out to be a rare and fatal disease. And were you able to be together more? Like, he died in Beverly Hills, so he...
Yes, he was at home for 10 months of his illness.
You don't flinch from describing the difficulty of caring for a critically ill person in this book. Despite the difficulties, why did you consider yourself relatively lucky?
Well, unlike most people who have to care for a family member who's critically ill, I could afford help. I could afford all the help I needed. And still, you can't escape. And it's very hard on the family and on any member of the household where someone is that ill. It brings up losses that everyone in the household has gone through. And you are just going from one day to the next and putting one foot in front of the other. So there's a huge luxury in having help, but finally your life is hijacked.
After he died, did you consider marrying again?
I didn't even date, much less marry. I couldn't even, I mean, dating, it was like, ugh.
So how did you meet Marshall Rose?
I was tricked. I was tricked and I didn't find out until the wedding dinner.
So, really?
Yes. That's
how were you tricked?
That's how naive I was. Marshall and Don Hewitt, who produced 60 Minutes, were friends. And my name came up, and Don said, "Would you like to meet her?" And he said, "Well, sure." And so Don pretended to have a dinner for me because he and I had been talking about my doing something on 60 Minutes. And then two nights before the dinner, he called and said, "Oh, and by the way, a man's going to pick you up before the dinner. His name is Marshall Rose." And so I didn't really think anything about it because he was very shrewd. Mm-hmm. If I had thought that it was a date or a fix-up, I just would have hightailed it away.
Marshall Rose was not in the business.
Not at all.
Was that important?
No.
Because a lot of people don't want to marry people who are in the same business.
And yet...
A lot of shop.
It is a lot of shop, but it's also the same tribe, which is a very nice common thread to have. But no, we're two very different tribes, different shops.
How old was your daughter at the time?
When we were married, she was 14.
Was that a consideration about whether you get married again?
Well, I mean, it was a very big consideration because we moved to New York. And that was asking a lot of her.
Did you have to bring him up to speed on popular culture?
Yeah.
And you were different religions?
Yes. He's Jewish and I'm a free-floating Gentile. And yes, I did. He'd never watched Seinfeld, for example. He didn't know. I said, Marshall, let's just have a little tutorial. We're going to put you in touch with the cultural touchstones. And so now, of course, he's more aware than I am.
Did Louis Malle watch shows? I mean, the equivalent of Seinfeld?
Louis liked to know what was going on everywhere. He was always prowling, and he was just always hungry for knowledge.
You've been married for 15 years.
Yeah.
A very different marriage, I assume, from the one you had with Louis.
Yeah.
You write that there's a hierarchy in acting. Theater is greater than film. Film is greater than TV. And you've worked in all of them with so many outstanding TV series. Do you think that hierarchy has changed?
Yeah. I think that it doesn't get better than great television. Great television is as good as it gets. And I think for a long time, far better than 99% of all movies. In intelligence, in ambition, in boldness and what it chooses to deal with, it is just outstanding.
Well, people are talking about us.
When you know the constraints of time, which are ridiculous, the fact that they turn out such incredible levels of product is just dazzling.
People are calling this a golden age, and that's probably partly because cable has raised the stakes.
Yeah.
Now the networks are having to live up to some of the standards that cable gave them. You were in another hit series, Boston Legal, with James Spader and William Shatner. So that must have been a bit of a relief. You didn't have to be in every scene.
No, but our television is a very different kettle of fish than half hour. It is an almost inhumane schedule for the crew and the cast. 18-hour days, I mean, it's really almost not even possible.
So nowadays you're doing guest appearances? You're going to be in Battle Creek?
Yeah, that was a great show to do. Very smart, very funny show. Those two guys are great.
And that's a show that's created by Vince Gilligan, who wrote Breaking
and
Bad.
And David Shore, by the man who created Breaking Bad and the man who created House. So it has a very smart DNA.
Your daughter is getting married this summer in her father's chateau in France.
Yes, she is.
Are you involved in the planning?
I am. We were there in February. We were meeting with caterers and redoing the barn. And
did you always intend to write a second memoir?
No, not at all.
This one, supposedly, you procrastinated for years.
Well, I procrastinated for years after I told Simon & Schuster that I would turn it in after a year. But it took four, and finally it took a phone call saying, hello. I never did intend to write a second one.
Do you enjoy the act of writing?
I sometimes do, but most of the time I don't.
So you won't continue, you won't be a third memoir, I assume?
I don't even think there's time for that.
But what about a novel or a book about other kinds of experiences? You have such an insider's knowledge of what goes on in theater, film, and TV.
You know, Leonard, I haven't gotten that far. I'm just hoping to survive the book tour.
You're realistic and self-deprecating about the aging process, and that's gotten some reactions.
Yes, a touch too realistic, some might say. Yes, well, aging, I mean, it's not for the faint of heart, let's be frank.
Well, you're aging well, so that helps. Candice Bergen will be speaking with Harry Smith tomorrow night at 7:30 at the 92nd Street Y. For ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. And the book's getting wonderful response, so that has to always
please
you. It's been
very nice, yes.
And it is called A Fine Romance. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And it has been, as always, a great pleasure to have Candice Bergen on the show today. But a reminder that you can get all the information you want about her appearance at the 92nd Street Y by going to our show page at WNYC.org.